Good afternoon. My name is Jennifer, and I will be your conference operator today. At this time, I would like to welcome everyone to the AAAS Science Conference Call. All lines have been placed on mute to prevent any background noise. After the speaker's remarks, there will be a question-and-answer session. If you would like to ask a question during this time, simply press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. If you have already done so, please press the pound sign, then press star one again to ensure your question is registered. If you would like to withdraw your question at any time, please press the pound sign. Thank you. I will now turn the conference over to Ms. Natasha Pinol with AAAS. You may begin.
Hello, and thank you for joining us today to discuss research that will appear in the journal Science Online at the Science Express website this Thursday. I'm Natasha Pinol, Senior Communications Officer in the AAAS Office of Public Programs. This embargo telebriefing is being made possible today through the generosity of the American Association for the Advancement of Science, the nonprofit International Science Society that publishes the journal Science, in cooperation with the Boston University School of Medicine and Boston Medical Center. A reminder that all information disclosed in this telebriefing will remain embargoed until 2 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time tomorrow, the Thursday, the 1st of July, 2010. On the line with me are Dr. Andrew Sugden, Deputy and International Managing Editor of the journal Science, and our speakers, who will each offer about 3-minute summaries of their primary conclusions. Dr. Tom Perls, Associate Professor of Medicine and Geriatrics at the Boston Medical Center and a senior author on the paper. He's also director of the New England Centenarian Study. And Dr. Paola Sebastiani, Professor of Biostatistics at the Boston University School of Public Health and lead and corresponding author on the Science paper. Dr. Andrew Sugden will first offer a few comments about science's perspective in publishing this research. Then the authors will participate in the question and answer session following their remarks. Thanks again for joining us, Andrew.
Good morning to everybody in the United States, and good afternoon to everyone in Europe. I'm Andrew Sugden, as Natasha said. I'm Deputy Editor for Biology based at Science's European office in Cambridge, UK. And I'll just make a few introductory remarks, which I'll keep as brief as possible, as I know there's going to be probably a lot of questions. Science is delighted to be publishing this unusual study on a topic that is likely to be of great interest to all of us, in other words, the aging process. And I'll just provide a brief introduction to this work. Making healthy lifestyle choices, such as eating a well-balanced diet or exercising regularly and avoiding exposure to tobacco, plays an undisputed role in determining how each of us will age, not only how long we will live, but also the quality of life we will experience in our final years. But genetics play an important role too, especially for individuals who live to an exceptionally old age. The Science paper that we'll hear about today begins to address the question of whether there's something genetically special about centenarians that allows them to age in a healthy way. And in work representing a fruitful collaboration between specialists in aging research and in bioinformatics and genetics, Paola Sebastiani, Tom Perls, and their colleagues compared the genetic profiles of 800 individuals enrolled in the New England Centenarian Study with those of random individuals. Through computer modeling, they found that indeed many of the centenarians shared a common genetic signature that distinguished them from control individuals, and that this signature could be used as a tool to predict extreme longevity. The centenarians could be subdivided into 19 smaller groups based on their genetic profiles. Future analyses of these smaller groups may shed light on how specific genes protect centenarians from common age-related diseases, such as dementia, heart disease, and cancer. So after those brief words, I'd like now to hand over to the authors to explain their research in more depth and to answer your questions. So many thanks again, and I'll first hand over to Dr. Tom Perls.
Thank you very, very much, Andrew, and hello to everyone. As Natasha indicated, I'm the director of the New England Centenarian Study at Boston Medical Center. And the New England Centenarian Study is the largest study of centenarians and their families in the world, and it's been going on since about 1995. And a great deal of the sample collection that has gone over this period of time has been funded by the National Institute on Aging and various foundations that are noted in the paper. We have approximately 1,600 centenarians in the study, that is people over the age of 100, and have by far and away the largest collection of what we call super centenarians, or people 110 or older, of any study that I know of. Centenarians are rare. They're about 1 per 6,000 in the population in industrialized countries. And super centenarians, that is 110 and older, are extremely rare at about 1 per 7 million in the population. Centenarians are indeed a model of aging well. A lot of people might ask, well, who would want to live to 100? Because they think they have every age-related disease under the sun and are on death's doorstep and certainly have Alzheimer's, but this isn't true. We have noted in previous work that 90% of centenarians are disability-free at the average age of 93, so they very much compress their diseases or their disability towards the very end of their lives. And super centenarians, indeed, they compress both disability and disease even further. The other thing that has happened over the course of our studies is that we have noted, and others have noted as well, that there's a very strong familial component to exceptional longevity. That and that in conjunction with some other work has always made us believe that genetics is playing a very important role in this wonderful trait. And we also felt that it couldn't boil down to just one or two genes, that it was certainly quite complex, probably involving many different pathways. We see this certainly in lower organism studies of lifespan. So with that in mind, we went ahead and embarked upon a genome-wide association study looking at about 300,000 markers across the genome known as single nucleotide polymorphisms and compared the findings in the centenarians with a very large sample of population control data supplied by Illumina to the various folks that use their chips. And what we found in that comparison initially using traditional frequentist analyses as well as Bayesian analysis is that we had about 70 significant SNPs that when we went ahead and looked in a separately enrolled study of centenarians at Elixir Pharmaceuticals, that 33 of those were replicated. But we felt also with the traditional analyses that a lot of data, a lot of results were being lost. And with that, I turn this over to Dr. Sebastiani.
Hi, I'm Paola Sebastiani. I'm a professor of biostatistics at Boston University School of Public Health. And I will tell you a little bit about the analysis, the innovative analysis that we conducted of this data. We developed a procedure that, a novel procedure that essentially delivered three main findings. First of all, we developed a genetic model that can be used to compute the predisposition of an individual to exceptional longevity. And the way this model works is you have to plug in the information at 150 genetic markers, and the model gives your chance of achieving exceptional longevity. We tested this model in an independent set of centenarians, and we achieved an accuracy of 77%, which means that out of 100 centenarians, we could correctly predict the outcome of 77%, while we incorrectly predicted the outcome of 23%. Now, on one side, 77% is a very high accuracy for a genetic model, which means that the traits that we are looking at has a very strong genetic base. On the other side, the 23% error rate can be interpreted in two ways. We can, of course, we know that we know a lot about the human genome, but we also know that there is a lot that remains to be discovered. So there may be genetic variants that we don't know yet who may have an important predictive value and were not included in our analysis. On the other side, we suspect that genetics is fundamental in exceptional longevity, but it's not the only thing. So there may be other factors like environment, the environment or other lifestyles that may help people live longer and healthier lives. Now, one of the features of this genetic model is that it produces what we call a genetic risk profile, which is essentially a picture, and one can interpret this picture in terms of how many longevity-associated variants a person is carrying in his genetic code. And when we were producing this picture, we realized that some of the profiles are more prevalent than others. So we analyzed them, and we discovered that based on their genetic risk profiles, centenarians can be grouped into 19 different groups that we call genetic signatures, and that these genetic signatures correlate with different patterns of exceptional longevity. For example, some signatures correlate with the longest survival. Other signatures correlate with the most delayed age of onset of age-related diseases, such as dementia or cardiovascular disease or hypertension. And therefore, these signatures represent the different genetic paths to age 100 and plus, and shed light on the genetics of healthy aging. A third analysis that we conducted was to verify or test the prevalence hypothesis that people live these very long and healthy lives because they do not carry genetic variants that predispose them to diseases. So we compare the number of disease-associated variants that have been found in other studies and are carried in centenarians and control. And very surprisingly, we found that centenarians and controls don't differ substantially in this number. This result that is very surprising suggests that what makes these people live a very long life is not a lack of genetic predisposition to diseases, but rather an enrichment of longevity-associated variants that may be protective and may even cancel the negative effect of disease-associated variants. And in particular, this analysis suggests that if you want to calculate the risk for a disease based on your disease-associated variants, your calculation may be incomplete if the overall genetic background is ignored. And we think that this analysis represents an important step forward in our understanding of the genetics of exceptional longevity as well as anti-aging. And we are open for questions now.
Okay, thank you. We'll open the call now for questions and questions from reporters. Operator?
Thank you. At this time, I would like to remind everyone, in order to ask a question, please press star, then the number 1 on your telephone keypad. Please refrain from using the pound sign, as this will remove your request from the queue. We'll pause for just a moment to compile the Q&A roster. Your first question comes from the line of Tina Say with Science News Magazine.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I was wondering if you can tell us anything about these people's lifestyles. Do the genetic variants that you find here pretty much solely determine their longevity? Or if these people led very unhealthy lifestyles, would they be likely to die young?
I'll begin with that, and then Paolo will probably have a follow-up. What we did is just based upon genetic data, we were able to group individuals as being a centenarian or a population control 77% of the time. We were able to do that accurately. So this is more just what could you do with the genetic data in terms of predicting whether a person was living to extreme old age or was a population control. As Paula had indicated in her introductory remarks, there's about 23% there where we don't get an accurate prediction, and that can be due to genetic factors that we don't know about, but also certainly environmental factors that are playing a role that we didn't have information on. With regard to the role of lifestyle, though, I think more broadly, we know from other studies like the Seventh-day Adventist Health Study that where those individuals have probably among the highest average life expectancy that we know in the United States of 88 years, that they get there by virtue of the fact that they have a religion that asks them to be vegetarian, they regularly exercise, they don't drink alcohol, they tend to manage their stress well through religion and time with family, and they don't smoke. And so they have an average life expectancy of 88 years, which is about 8 years longer than the rest of the country on average. And it really does speak to the incredible importance of lifestyle factors. Now, to live the additional 10, 15 years beyond the age of 88, our paper is indicating that genetics are playing an increasingly important role in distinguishing those individuals from the average population.
Do you know the actual frequency of these signatures that you find in the centenarians in the average population?
We have analyzed a large set of controls, and so we have an estimate of how rare these signatures are. So far, we see that in our set of controls, we have about 15% of controls who have a predisposition to exceptional longevity. However, one thing one has to be careful is that these controls are not really, may not be totally representative of the general population. So one has to conduct more studies to be able to answer this question.
So
15.15%.
So that's considerably higher than the 1% of centenarians that you actually see in the population.
Right. It's likely, one can conjecture that genetically we're built to live longer, and that's, with changes in public health, mainly public health, we are actually seeing this increasing life expectancy in people.
Okay, it looks like we'll take another question, please.
The next question is from Carolyn Johnson with the Boston Globe.
Hi, thanks for taking my question. I just wondered if you could explain in a little more detail how you control for the fact that the control group you're using was not born between 1890 and 1910, and whether you might be finding genetic signatures that have nothing to do with longevity, but maybe something about just these are different populations, like they weren't born at the same time.
Right, this is an important question, and to try to reduce as much as possible issues, other confounders in our analysis, we actually used an algorithm to match the genetic background of controls to that of the centenarians as closely as possible. So we matched them based on the genetic ancestry, and in theory this should also remove possible confounders due to other factors that we cannot control for.
But is it how certain can you be that you haven't measured other differences? Like, would full genome sequencing answer those questions? Or more carefully, are you confident that you have controlled adequately for it? I mean, it seems like the ultimate test would be to replicate these findings in another group, right?
And so far we have replicated the findings in another study. And of course, with more genetic data becoming available, we plan to replicate and try to replicate the study further. There will be other studies with the genetic data becoming available to us next year, in which we can try also to verify this test, this hypothesis of the birth year cohort effect.
Okay.
But the data are not available yet to us.
And can you also just explain, you know, what you plan to do with this research? Is the goal to investigate the, like, biochemical pathways that each of these 150 variants could influence? It's a lot of different factors to look at. So how would this be useful to understand healthy aging, since there seems to be so much complexity?
Right. We have a long list of things to do here. Some of these genetic markers point to genes that are already known to have a role in exceptional longevity, like APOE, but others are totally novel, and we plan to follow up these results, first trying to identify the real functional variants that determine changes at biological level, and we also hope that what we have found will trigger the interest of other investigators, so who will follow up these findings with the functional experiments to understand the real biology behind what we have found.
Great, thanks so much.
Your next question is from the line of Randolph Schmidt with the Associated Press.
Yes, hello. I'm curious, at what point do you expect, or do you expect, to become possible for people to get tested, and would they be able to apply the findings in the genetic variants to suggest specific lifestyle changes that might help them live longer?
Please understand that we really embarked upon the study first and foremost to try and understand more about the genetics of exceptional longevity,
mm-hmm.
and to, as Paola had indicated, invigorate ourselves as well as others to perform follow-up studies to take the next steps to understand the interaction of these genes and the biology of perhaps aging slowly and avoiding age-related diseases. The signatures that Paola described in her introductory remarks are very interesting in terms of how you can have a number of centenarians, say 30 or more centenarians, that fall into the same genetic signature, and then you see what other things that they have in common. For those who had a signature with the greatest enrichment of longevity-associated variants, it was remarkable how that correlated with the most extreme ages in our sample. So 40% of our supercentenarians had three signatures in common, or there were three signatures common amongst that group. Other signatures could show, for example, a marked delay in the age of onset of dementia, or heart disease, or diabetes and stroke. Other signatures would show individuals who get to these very old ages despite the presence of those diseases for quite a long time. So understanding better the different pathways of getting to 100 will be very important. And to kind of directly answer your question, could these signatures tell a physician and their patient who's going to be at increased risk for a particular disease sooner, and can this lead perhaps to interventions that might help them? I think that's a possibility down the road, and it brings up this whole field of personal genomics or medicine and being able to use genetic information in the future to help guide therapy. Indeed, a chip could be made with these 150 SNPs that would allow people, with the accuracy that we've come up with, at least for Caucasians, I think this has to be done with other ethnicities, and indeed we're going to closely collaborate with a study in Japan to do this, where they have a large number of centenarians. But you could conceivably produce a chip that would help predict people's genetic predisposition for exceptional longevity. But all the authors of this paper want to instill a great deal of caution in thinking about what people might actually do with that information. And I think that this very much needs to be studied further. Will that stop companies from going ahead and doing this? Probably not. But certainly, as the academicians and researchers behind this, we think it's really important to understand what people end up doing with this information, including thinking about the potential for social and what people do in terms of social entitlements and things like that. So we think that that merits a lot more discussion.
Okay, thank you.
The next question is from the line of Laura Ricci with El Soleil Venta Quattro Ore.
Yes, thank you. I would like to know a bit more about the geographical origin of the centenarians, in particular if there are the Italian centenarians from Sardinia or Calabria, and if the genetic signature is different depending on the geographical origin of the centenarians, if you can cluster them, if they are similar, the one that comes from the same era.
Right. We have a certain proportion of centenarians with the origin from the south of Italy and some with origin from north of Italy. We actually collaborate with an investigator from Italy, Annibale Puca, in the study of longevity. Our signature at the moment don't seem to correlate with the ethnicity. So we have checked, and there are no differences really at the that we can test at the level of ethnicity. At the same time, it's true that we have about 1,000 centenarians that we have studied, and when we start identifying the different ethnic groups in Europe, we identified about 16 in the centenarians. So the numbers go down very rapidly, and this is something that has to be verified in the future once we get. We can collaborate with the other studies of centenarians in Europe. And our plan is to actually collaborate with the study of Claudio Franceschi and then the study of centenarians in Germany and possibly also French centenarians.
Thank you.
Okay, we'll take the next question, please.
The next question is from the line of Joe Hall with Toronto Star.
Hi, thanks for taking this. I just wondered if this opens the possibility at all to look at these genes if you can pinpoint some of the more important ones, to using them or their products to, you know, create some kind of longevity cocktail for people who aren't blessed with the genetic profile that these people have.
And then we start getting into the whole question of elixirs like resveratrol, and actually there's a very interesting study being done at the NIA on rapamycin based upon lower organism study findings. With regard to the genetic findings we have here, clearly we realize that this is a very complex genetic puzzle. These 150 markers point to approximately 70 or so genes, and one of the important parts of the study is the analytic techniques that are introduced in the study help capture that complexity and can take into account the interaction of many genes in playing a role in this trait. I think that we're quite a ways away still in understanding how what pathways governed by these genes are involved and how the interaction of these genes, not just with themselves but with environmental factors, are all playing a role in this longevity puzzle. So do I think that this could still, nonetheless, down the road, lead to some kind of cocktail? My hope has always been with the study that we would learn much more about how to get lots of people to live to older age in good health and markedly delay their disability and age of onset of diseases towards the very end of their lives, however long that would be. I look at the complexity of this puzzle and feel very strongly that this will not lead to treatments that will get a lot of people to become centenarians, but rather to make a dent in the onset of age-related diseases like Alzheimer's, for example.
So these people have, for example, are clustered into groups where Alzheimer's is obviously less prevalent and later and has a later onset, and there are genes associated with that that may have the lack of complexity to be useful in terms of a therapeutic. Is that what you're saying?
I think that it's correct that that 90% of the centenarians are delaying their disability well into their early 90s, and so that's really quite old when you consider the average age of onset of Alzheimer's among those who develop it later in life. And I'm very hopeful that understanding why and how centenarians are able to do that will lead to strategies and therapies, including screening and figuring out who can be helped by whatever therapy is down the road. So I think there's actually great promise in what we've done here along those lines.
Thank you.
Next question is from Joseph Corbella with LaVanguardia.
Yes, thank you. Does your research shed any light on the mechanisms related to longevity in previous studies, such as metabolism, sirtuins or telomerase? And also, have you looked in your genome-wide association studies at mitochondrial DNA or just nuclear DNA?
We haven't looked yet at mitochondrial DNA. And in terms of the findings that we have, we see a lot of results consistent with the previous the results from previous investigations. For example, we see association with extreme longevity of genes involved with Alzheimer's disease, with chromosomal instability, with the insulin pathway. We have a very long list to go through of a set of 150 markers that cover many different biological processes.
We'll take another question, please.
Your next question is from Cheryl Ublacker with the Canadian Press.
Yes, hi. Thanks for doing this. Can you tell me how many super centenarians you had in the group, and were there more men and women or women in the whole cohort, please?
Currently, we're fast approaching our magic number of 110-year-olds or older, but in this study, we had approximately 50 supercentenarians in the study, and centenarians in general, women are very much win the longevity marathon, so 85% of centenarians are women and 15% are men. That may go down to about 1 in 9 are men for the supercentenarians.
And do we know why this is, that women are living more prone to have this longevity? Was there anything different in their genetic makeup?
For this study, there wasn't any difference between the men and women. As to why women do so much better than men, there's an interesting paradox in that though there are far fewer men among this group, and this doesn't come from this particular research, but it's been shown in a number of centenarian studies now, the men tend to be much better off than the women. And the thought is that men generally are more susceptible to the mortality associated with age-related diseases, and you get this selecting out phenomenon where the men who have these diseases die off, leaving behind a select cohort of survivors. And so they do quite a bit better. Once they do get an illness, they more readily die. But as a result, the centenarian men tend to be functionally quite fit compared to the women. The women, on the other hand, have this double-edged sword that they seem to be much better able to handle these diseases, perhaps through some kind of functional reserve or adaptive capacity that hasn't been well quantified as of yet. And but as a result, they also then generally have higher levels of disability compared to the men, but then they live longer than the men as well. There's a number of theories as to why women live longer than men. I discussed some of those actually on the New England Centenarian website. I think the URL is in the press release.
Okay, just one last thing. What does this tell, you know, the average person out there who's going to read our stories or see our programs on television?
In terms of what's kind of the main message that comes from the research?
Yes.
Well, I think that exceptional longevity is not this vacuous entity that no one can figure out. That I think we've made quite some inroads here in terms of demonstrating a pretty important genetic component to this wonderful trait. And this really opens the door, I think, to future research in terms of a much better understanding of not just the genetic determinants, but certainly also the environmental and lifestyle determinants. And so I think it's really quite a very optimistic message.
Okay. Thank you so much, Dr. Pearl.
Well, thank you.
Your next question is from Daniel Danoon with WebMD.
Thank you for taking my question. I wanted to go back to the question. Clearly, a chip with your markers is probably going to already being created. What do you have to say to people who are going to be curious and going to want to seek out this kind of testing? What do you think they will learn and will not learn? And what caveats would you suggest to people who will seek out this kind of information for themselves?
As you know, there's been quite a bit of controversy already brought before the FDA and Congress around these genetic tests, not so much for Mendelian traits that are very well defined by just a few, if not one, genetic variation, but for complex diseases that have many different genes and environmental factors playing roles. And whether or not those tests are reliable and accurate, certainly the 77% accuracy that's touted in this paper is fairly unprecedented. But I think we got there because of just how strongly genetic this trait likely is, particularly when you get to even older and older ages, that is, going from 100 to 105 to 110 and older. But one of the very interesting findings that came out of the work that needs additional study and replication is when we looked at a lot of disease-associated variants from the literature and looked at the number of those variants that occurred in the centenarians and occurred in the controls, to our surprise, really, the centenarians didn't really significantly differ from the controls. We had long hypothesized that to get to 100, you have to have a relative lack of disease-associated variants. But in this case, we're finding that not to be the case, and that what may be the difference is the enrichment and presence of these longevity-associated variants that, as Paula had said in her introductory remarks, could trump or cancel the effect of some of these disease-associated variants. So until these tests that are being sold in pharmacies and what have you take into account the presence of other genes that could be playing canceling or attenuating effects, I think that they're not quite ready for prime time. It is a test for exceptional longevity ready for prime time, and as I said in my introductory remarks, I think a lot more study needs to be done as to what guidance physicians and other healthcare providers and the research community can give to individuals as to what they would do with this information. What do you do when you're told you absolutely don't have the signature for exceptional longevity? Or you have, and then you go and do a lot of risk-taking behaviors and say, well, I'm hanging it up. Or does it give you impetus to take all the more better care of you and to absolutely recognize that you may well fall into the 23% of individuals who don't have the signature but very well could go on to be 100, like 23% of our centenarian sample did. And then there could be those individuals, I suppose, who have this amazing signature, like some of our supercentenarians that have practically all the longevity-associated variants and are rich for those. And then what is the, and that's highly predictive of going on to 110. Then I start worrying a bit about what insurance companies and others might do with that information. So I, for one, think it's not ready from a social point of view, but I agree with you that that's not going to stop companies from trying to market this.
Thank you. That answers my question.
The next question is from Stacy Singer with the Palm Beach Post.
My question, that's exactly the subject I was curious about. You have women, for example, who are choosing to have their breasts removed if they carry both the BRCA, you know, or the 1 or 2 gene. Did you look at BRCA, for example, or the Alzheimer's genes? Did you find that that there might be something protective elsewhere in the genome that would render those genes not so harmful that maybe we need to know more about?
We didn't look at those specific variants because we have the type of genetic data we have is limited by the arrays, the commercial arrays that we use.
Mm.
But that's something that definitely we plan to do in the future.
I remember that this was not like a candidate gene approach where we just kind of picked a bunch and came up with 150 and ran with that. That would never work. And I'm not insinuating that you thought that, but just to make that clear, that instead, as explained in the paper, we used a model we used the data in such a way that the model produced 150 markers, and to add additional ones to that really didn't improve the accuracy of the model. And so we had these 150 markers, and BRCA1 or BRCA2, that wasn't available on the chip that we used, so we wouldn't have known about that. APOE did come up in our set. That there's a well-known association between APOE4 and Alzheimer's disease. But a number of other genes that I think we brought up in the previous question came up as well. And indeed, maybe there are other genes that cancel out some of the disease-associated variants that are part of this 150 set.
Thank you.
Again, if you would like to ask a question, press star, then the number 1 on your telephone keypad. Please refrain from using the pound sign. This will remove your request from the queue. Your next question is from the line of Emily Singer with Technology Review.
Hi, yeah, I wanted to follow up on a couple of the numbers. I think that you mentioned that the control group, 15% of that group had a longevity signature, but that the percentage of centenarians in the general population is about 1 in 600. So how do you resolve those numbers? Is there a large percentage of people dying for other reasons?
I can. The centenarians are actually 1 per 6,000 in the population.
Okay.
But it's a big country, so we have about 80,000 centenarians alive at any one time. It's a relatively rare trait when you think about the prevalence of other illnesses or traits. And but certainly that's a lot less than 15% of our population. You're absolutely right. And so, you know, Jim Bopel, who's a very prominent investigator and researcher in our field, and we cite his work in the paper addressing this issue. He's the director of the Max Planck Institute of Demography in Germany, feels that there really is even a higher potential proportion of the population that has the opportunity, particularly among women, to live to 100. And I think we have found a number somewhere in between where 15% has a genetic signature that increases their probability somewhere between 65 and 98% of living to 100 in terms of having what it takes genetically. If they're not hit by a bus, if they're not in a war, if they haven't had some other accident happen, maybe they get to fulfill that. Now, a bunch of those people may also need to not smoke and not to be obese, and a number of important lifestyle factors as well. So there's a large range of explanations as to whether the 15% in our population is going to have an opportunity to go on to be 100 or not.
Okay, thank you.
Again, if you would like to ask a question, press star, then the number 1 on your telephone keypad. Please refrain from using the pound sign. This will remove your request from the queue. Your next question is from Robert Holt with the Wall Street Journal.
Good morning. I wonder, since you've several times now kind of addressed the tension between the basic research aspect of this finding, our general ignorance so far about its social import, and what you suggest will be the alacrity with which the commercial marketplace will take this up. I wonder if you could just tell us about your own financial arrangements here. Are you interested in copywriting this signature? Are you going to try to patent it? Have you already filed for such? Are you just making this kind of an open source thing? Would you just explicate that for us, please?
Right. So we have no financial interest, and we are no going on or planning to patent anything here. And we are actually we have one of the co-authors of the paper who's working very hard to create a website in which people knowing their genetic code can then compute the predisposition to exceptional longevity. And the website also will provide some description of how to interpret the results in the right context.
And to make that openly available to the public.
Would you just expand a little bit about the website? This is something that's in process. Just walk me through what this website will do for people.
Yeah, it's something in process, and it will be an applet in which you can put you need to know your genetic data, and then this applet will compute your genetic risk profile for exceptional longevity.
Do you have any idea when this website and this applet might be available? 6 months, a year?
Oh, no, we hope that it will be ready maybe next week. It's one of the authors of the paper is one of the students working with me, and he's a kind of a more computer science geek, so he was working very hard to make this available as soon as possible.
And when this applet is available, how would people find out about it? Would it be on the New England Centenary Study homepage or where?
We will put it on the New England Centenarian Study webpage.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Your next question is from Luis Miguel Ariza with LPS.
Thank you very much. I have only a couple of questions. One of them is about location, about geography. Of course, this genetic signature in these supercentenarians are located in a particular zone of in a particular chromosome in your research. And if that segment of DNA are connected with maybe the production of some protein or just a signature, they are silent. That's my first question. And the second question is, talking generally about longevity, which country or location has the most highest number of supercentenarians in the world? Thank you very much.
Now, the size of 150 markers are spread all over the chromosomes, and so they don't point to one specific region of or one specific chromosome. They are distributed all over the 23 chromosomes, and they suggest they confirm our conjecture that this is an extremely complex genetic trait that involves many different biological processes.
And with regard to who has the most supercentenarians, I know of no particular region that has a enrichment of supercentenarians. There's been long, you know, there's always been these myths from the Caucasus of Russia and Azerbaijan and other regions that purport to have extremely old individuals, 122, 140, and what have you, and all of those have been proven to not be true. The oldest person ever with really good validation was Madame Camon, who died at 122 in 1997. I think the oldest person currently is probably around 116. You know, Japan probably does a pretty good job, and they're probably pretty close to having one of the longest average life expectancies, and they do seem to have a lot of centenarians. We don't know if that is really significantly different than other regions like the United States.
Okay, and especially talking about Japan, for instance, is there any reason why we can explain this higher number, or practically we don't know anything about?
I'm sorry, can you repeat the question, please?
Yes, he talked about Japan has the highest number of centenarians, probably one country which is doing a good job.
There's been some really interesting studies also sponsored by the National Institute on Aging looking at differences between Japanese, those who live in Hawaii and those who live in Japan, and starting to dissect out perhaps environmental and lifestyle differences between the two. And until recently anyway, the Japanese tend to have this Mediterranean-like diet, a lot of seafood in their diet, seaweed. They tend to be quite, they do a lot of walking, they don't do that, a heck of a lot of driving. Unfortunately, I think there's been a bit of westernization going on in terms of increased intake of red meat and smoking. That's going to be a problem there. But I think that there's some really important lifestyle differences that allow that population to be a bit healthier.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Okay, and that was Luis Miguel Ariza from El País. I think we have time for a few more questions.
And your next question is from Margaret Monroe with CanWest News.
Hi there. Thank you very much for taking the question. I just want to get back to this business about overriding, it seems, of known genetic risk factors. And
can you speak a little bit more loudly, please?
Oh, sorry. I wanted to ask a bit more about these genetic risk factors. Are you saying that if someone has, say, APOE4, if they've got these other factors, their chance of getting Alzheimer's goes back down to normal?
There have been a number of reports in the literature of centenarians who have an APOE4 allele or variant and got to their very old age despite that. And so certainly that brings up the possibility that they have something else that negates the effect of that genetic exposure. There are a number of researchers that are, of course, quite interested in that.
But does that not sort of, don't these results then sort of throw into question a lot of the genetic testing that's already done? Like if people are being said, oh, you've got this genetic predisposition, and then maybe there's something else that can override it, doesn't it sort of point to the need to be very careful with the tests we already got out there?
Yeah, absolutely. We actually think that it's important that the information about the disease predisposing variants has to be put in the right context. And, I mean, when you think about it, it makes a lot of sense. When you take a piece of information out of context, it can be misleading. So here, what we are seeing is that the overall genetic background can play a major role. And these models that this test predict compute the predisposition to disease based on some disease-associated variants with the out of context may be not maybe not accurate.
And I will just add something to that as a clinician, that certainly in the case of Alzheimer's disease, clinicians will use whether or not you have an APOE4 from mom or dad or from both in helping them make their diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease. But that's what Paola said was absolutely right. It has to be taken into the context of what else is going on with the patient. Do they have a memory loss and other clinical features that are consistent with making that diagnosis? What was the age of onset? What other medical problems are they having and what have you? So the genetic information needs to be just one piece of the information that you're using to make these diagnoses and to hopefully make as accurate a diagnosis as you can. I just wanted to add one more general note because I know that we're coming to an end, and that is if anyone has more questions or was concerned about not getting their question answered because of the queue, you can certainly contact us through the numbers on the press release and we'll certainly be available to answer more questions.
And also the information is on the Science Press package.
Yes.
Yes.
Okay, can I ask another question just quickly? Do not a lot of these old people, is it not in their families? Like, could you not tell by looking at their family that there's a really high chance, like probably a 77% chance that they'll live to 100?
Actually, this is an important distinction to make. So if you have, if you know that you have familial longevity, and you are in a group of siblings, and you know your parents got to live to 115, then you know that you have a chance to achieve, you know, you have a high probability of living long yourself. What this specific genetic information has is information about you specifically. So with your genetic data, then we can tell you exactly. We can compute what is your specific predisposition to exceptional longevity.
But I agree with you, actually, just in terms of accessibility to information, what have you. We actually also participate in another study called the Long Life Family Study, run by the in collaboration with the National Institute on Aging and several other institutions, that really looks very closely at familial longevity and trying to understand what family members have in common that explain clustering for longevity in certain families. I think it's very powerful to just look at your family tree and see what kind of longevity is running through it. It may give you some additional information. Along the same lines, it's very important to look at various diseases and what people are dying of so that you can get an idea of what risk factors are not good for your family members, and you need to avoid those as well. So I think there's a lot of information one can get by looking at their own family tree.
Thanks very much. Okay, we'll take the next question, please.
Your next question is from Rachel Bernstein with the Los Angeles Times.
Hi. I just had a quick question about this website. You said that you would need to have your own genetic data to input. Does that mean that you would have to have your whole genome sequenced or just know some of your SNPs, or what actually would be the data that you would input?
At the moment, what we are thinking is that just this genetic data of these 150 markers. That's what the model needs to compute your predisposition to exceptional longevity.
Right, but as an individual person who's going to use the website, would you wouldn't go through your genome and pick those out, so would it likely come from having your whole genome sequenced?
Those data would be available from like a standard chip.
And is that someone that is that something that an individual could run themselves, I guess, is what I'm asking. could an individual get the chip and get those data and then put it into the website?
There certainly would be companies and perhaps even academic labs and whatever study that they may be interested in conducting along the lines of what we're doing here, where those data could be obtained.
Okay, so, but it's unlikely that an individual person would just be accessing that information themselves. They would probably go through a company or a study.
Well, yeah, it entails getting your DNA isolated from a blood sample, and then a laboratory that has access to these chips actually telling you the variations for each of these 150 markers, and having that provided in such a way that it could then be put into the software program that will be available on the website.
Okay, thank you.
We have time for two last questions.
Your next question is a follow-up from Stacy Singer with the Palm Beach Post.
Thanks. That was my question exactly. Thank you.
Your next follow-up question from Laura Ricci with El Soleil Venta Cuatro Ore.
Oh.
Hello?
Her line has been removed from the queue.
Oh.
Okay, I guess that was our last question for today. On behalf of Science and its publisher, AAAS, I want to thank the panelists for participating today and the reporters. Reminder that the paper and related materials are embargoed until tomorrow, Thursday, the 1st of July, 2 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time. The paper will appear in print at a later date. Audio files and a transcript of this briefing will be posted on the Science Press Package website this afternoon, where the papers, visuals, and multimedia files are housed. If you have any further questions, please contact me or the Science Press team at 202-326-6440. Thank you.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. This does conclude today's conference call. You may now disconnect your lines.